Welcome to the KTEP Book Club on Perspectives. I'm your host, Louis Sines. I'm breaking rocks in the hot sun. I fought the law and the law won. I fought the law and the law won. And joining us on Perspectives today is Miriam Linna. Miriam is the author of the recent book, I Fought the Law, The Life and Strange Death of Bobby Fuller. And Miriam, we want to thank you very much for coming on the show to be here with us. And the book that we're discussing, I Fought the Law, The Life and Strange Death of Bobby Fuller, you co-wrote with Bobby's brother. Is that correct?
Yes, with Randall Fuller.
Now, how did this come about? I mean, there have been a lot of stories about Bobby Fuller, a lot of conspiracy theories, a lot of, unsolved mysteries. It's been on featured on various shows, various books. And in fact, you came on to one of the shows that is carried here by one of our local stations, Coast to Coast. And they do a lot of interviews with people who talk about secrets or unsolved mysteries. And so, you know, people here in El Paso are very interested in Bobby Fuller and the Bobby Fuller Four, which, of course, made that great big hit, I Fought the Law. And actually, they had two hits. We'll talk about the other one in just a minute. But tell us about how did you and Randy come about deciding to tell this story? Was it because of all the conspiracy theories and everything else that perhaps Randy might have said, I want to set the story straight?
Okay, Louis. Well, actually, the thrust of the original interest for me with Bobby Fuller was not the various theories of how he died and what the involvements were there. My interest was primarily and actually entirely his remarkable career in music, especially those early days in El Paso. I found it really intriguing that a teenager, and really a guy going into his very early 20s at that time, was able to write, record, have a record label that he started himself, build a studio in his garage, promote himself, start his own teen club, completely redefine what teenage music was in the Southwest, and go on to a very meteoric and short-lived success in the national and international kind of way. But my main interest really was him as a musician. When I first got in touch with Randall, it goes back about 25 years. I was writing a story on Bobby for Kix magazine out of Brooklyn, New York here, and it turned into a really, really lengthy story that I really threw a lot of energy and love into. I was able at that time to interview all of the members of the Bobby Fuller Four, except Bobby, of course, who were alive at that time. Since then, we've lost Jim Reese, in particular, the other guitar player in the group. But I was able to interview them and also Steve Krosno from Kelp, who you, I'm sure, are well aware of, and sure, all of your listeners are. Well, Steve was alive at that time, and I had a wonderful couple of visits with him in which he described Bobby's career and the careers of many musicians in El Paso at the time. And, of course, he gave the first real local attention to Bobby's independent releases there in El Paso and drove him to the top of the charts. He really loved him. So I was intrigued by the various studios that were set up there in the area. He also recorded at Yucca, which was in Alamogordo, had records released on the Yucca label. He traveled to Norvajack. He tried to follow the Buddy Holly kind of template. All the names that came up for Buddy Holly, he tried to follow because he was a huge fan, as were many Texans at that time, also people across the country. But musicians in Texas, I think, particularly loved Buddy Holly so much, and Bobby and Randy were both also members of that incredible fan club of Buddy Holly's fans.
We're visiting with Miriam Linna. Miriam is the author of the book, I Fought the Law, The Life and Strange Death of Bobby Fuller. Miriam, you mentioned the DJ Steve Krosno. And in the 1960s, a lot of groups depended on the DJ to play their music, and a lot of them almost became mm-hmm. associated with a group such as Murray the K, as the Fifth Beatle. And so in this book, you mention another DJ that everybody recognizes, and that's Casey Kasem.
That's right. Casey really took them under his wing when they got out to California. He immediately heard the talent and loved the personality of Bobby Fuller and of all the band members. He really thought that they had a chance at stardom, and of course they did. And he followed them, he promoted them, he was on radio in California and also organized many, many shows for them.
As far as Bobby's music, we know that in the 1960s, of course, and we just interviewed an author, college professor, not too long ago about Beatlemania and the fans and the role that the media played and the DJs. And so in that day and age, tell us a little bit about what the music scene was like in El Paso and in general, because the 60s had some very good music.
Oh, it surely did. Now, my perspective of what was going on in your town, in El Paso, you know, comes from somebody who's from the other end of the spectrum, going the far northeast. So it was very intriguing to me to think of what was going on in this particular location. I knew quite a bit about Texas music coming from Fort Worth and Dallas and Houston and Austin and various other points in Texas, but El Paso seemed to always be Bobby Fuller only. I mean, that was really the name that came out of El Paso, and it was intriguing to think that, wow, how did this one guy happen to come out, and did he happen in a vacuum? Well, as the days and years went on with really getting involved with El Paso music history, we really uncovered the fact that there were dozens and dozens of incredible, intriguing groups that came out and were happening at the same time, before, during, and after Bobby Fuller. You had a very, very incredible scene there with rock and roll, with instrumental music, with rhythm and blues. You had Long John Hunter and Little Joe Washington there across the river in Juarez, who were an incredible influence on young musicians there, including Bobby. And I think it's that sound, which I really consider to be an El Paso sound, not a very unique sound even in Texas music, that kind of brings in the infusion of the rhythm and blues, soul, the Mexican influence, rock and roll, the radio influences that came in through things like radio stations like KELP that brought in all of these different flavors into the music and really turned it around with that wild desert kind of a feeling that I hear in El Paso Records that's almost brutal in its loneliness and in its attitude.
Miriam, correct me if I'm wrong, but you are a musician yourself, are you not?
Well, I play drums, yes.
Yes, you're a drummer, percussionist.
I'm a drummer and a singer, so, but don't cut that against me, okay, Louis?
Okay, I guess we can use the line where somebody used that when they were reviewing your book, and they said there is a difference between someone who plays music and a musician, and Bobby was a musician. So
yes, he definitely was.
So you consider yourself a musician, someone who plays music? There are some write-ups about you. And you're a pretty good drummer.
Well, I don't think I'm that bold, and I don't know if Bobby would have been either. But you know, he was a born musician. He picked up any instrument and he could play it. Randall describes in the book the amazement and kind of the tense attitude that happened out of this, in the fact that he was the first to really pick up a guitar. You know, Bobby was busy with every other instrument except guitar. Randy picked up guitar, and you know, he thought, okay, well, I'm going to be the guitar player in the family. Oh, Bobby excels at everything else. He was in military at a military academy at that time. When he came home for break, he was dismayed to find that his brother had not only picked up a guitar, but he was absolutely fantastic at it. In a couple of few months, his brother had completely become the local guitar player. And, of course, Randy wanted to play guitar, and Bobby said, well, look, if I'm starting my own band, you have to play bass. And Randy was, oh, well, I better play bass. And he became the best bass player in town. So, but Bobby really was a musician's musician. Everyone in El Paso will attest to that. The people who recorded with him, recorded for him, at his studio, who he recorded for at other studios and labels and so on, saw that he was really a force to be reckoned with.
We're visiting with Miriam Lina. She is the author of the book, I Fought the Law, The Life and Strange Death of Bobby Fuller. And Mina, I'm going to read a little bit from the back of the book. And the cover is very interesting because it's got a great picture of Randy Fuller in front of KELP, what was then KELP Studios, and now it's KVIA Channel 7 here in El Paso. But anyone who sees that picture will recognize it right away. I'm going to read from the back of the cover. It says, Bobby Fuller was the self-proclaimed rock and roll king in the Southwest. He wrote and recorded his own music, built his own studio, released his own records, but he was left to die in his mother's car, beaten and doused with gasoline on July 18, 1966. And now his brother tells the inside story for the first time ever. And I guess our fans of Bobby Fuller and people who are listening, whether or not they be fans of rock and roll or Bobby Fuller, they want to know, okay, this is intriguing. Tell me. What happened?
Well, apart from having to read the book,
right.
I'll fill you in, Louis. Randall was telling the story for the first time. He chose to tell it from the very earliest days because he really felt that this was an opportunity for him to tell a story that's been told incorrectly so many times. People really didn't know exactly what kind of family Bobby came from. They basically knew him for his hit songs and for the horrendous way that he died and the fact that it's a mystery. And, of course, that's intriguing to the world at large. But for people who really respect his music and have listened to his records over the years and several different groups of recordings have surfaced over the past 50 years of Bobby's that nobody heard before, and now being able to hear them, they really realized that the man had so much talent and so much music to record. Randy really wanted people to know that. He wanted to know the struggles from the time that they were young to the time that they were teenagers, and then going to California, really at a point where they didn't know if they wanted to go. It wasn't as though they were driven to go to California at that time. Randy sometimes blamed himself for thinking that, you know, California is the next step. Did Bobby really, really want to go to California at that point in time? It's hard to tell, but there's always been that moment of doubt of what if we hadn't have gone? Would he have been alive today? Would he have become a much bigger star locally there in El Paso, maybe opened another teen club because the Rendezvous teen club that he had was forced to close toward the end of summer 1964, and he was about to open another one. There were struggles there, and then they just took the opportunity to move to California and give it another shot. But really, had he stayed in El Paso, what would have happened? Would he have really opened a huge studio and had extreme success there with the new club and kept up with this incredible following that he already had? Most likely, but he took that gamble and went to California. Unfortunately, it was a gamble with his life. Yes, when he went there, December of 1964, pretty much immediately things started to happen. He was very fortunate. He didn't have to struggle that hard to find a record label. He went around to many of them, but went back to one that he had visited a couple of years earlier with his brother when they were taking their tapes around. He went back to Bob Keane at Delphi Records. Delphi had just started a new wing, a new little label called Mustang that was part of a larger corporation that had come in called Stereophy. But to Bobby, it was Delphi. You know, it was the Richie Valens, the label. You know, it was that connection one person over from Buddy Holly. He thought it was great. Of course, a Mustang did focus on the Bobby Fuller Four, as they became called. They were the Fanatics when they were in El Paso, but they took on the name the Bobby Fuller Four, and the recordings were stellar. They immediately got a residency first at La Cave Pigalle at the Ambassador Hotel, which was a wonderful venue for a group coming from out of town and being able to land a venue like that, and then at P PJs, which plays a huge part in actually Bobby's demise, and in, you know, before that, in the growth of his career, because he had a long standing relationship with a nightclub called PJs.
We're visiting with Miriam Lena. She is the author of the book, I Fought the Law, The Life and Strange Death of Bobby Fuller. Now, the people, fans, just like anything, you know, they want to know, okay, there are conspiracy theories. There are different sides to the story. But, of course, the news media and some of the law agencies also said that it was a suicide.
Initially, that's what it was declared. Now, Louie, it was unfortunate that Bobby's death coincided pretty much at the same time, 2 days later, from the death of Chief William Parker, who was the longest-standing police chief in LAPD history. He died suddenly 2 days before Bobby, and it was totally unexpected. Chief Parker passed away suddenly, and this threw the entire police force in Los Angeles into a terrible situation where they had to fill the boots of Parker immediately, and of course the funeral had to be planned. The funeral for autopsy, funeral, everything that goes along with the death of a major figure, especially a major police figure in Los Angeles, everything, media, all of the attention was thrown to Chief Parker's death. The sparse crew of police officers that were there on tap for Bobby's death when he was found dead in his mother's car in the most unusual circumstances, with gasoline on him, with gasoline fumes permeating the automobile, with a gas can in the vicinity, with apparent bruising and damage to his body, which had already gone into rigor mortis and was exhibiting different things that happen to a body when it's been in a car for a long time. The heat had gone up to 96 degrees there in Los Angeles at the time. They really didn't know exactly when was the time of death, how long he had been in the car, whether he had driven himself there, whether someone else had driven him there and just scooted him over toward the driver's seat and then he had fallen over. What exactly was the situation? Had he ever even left the parking lot? So the speculation ran wild, and the immediate proclamation of suicide was picked up by local papers and splashed around. Immediately, the press went to Bobby's parents and to his mother, and they asked the obvious question, was he depressed? Excuse me. Was he depressed? Was he despondent? And she made the mistake, innocently, of saying that yes, maybe he was. You know, I mean, you ask anyone, you know, it's like, are you depressed? Well, you know, he was about to split off the following day, the day after his death. He missed the meeting. That's how they found his body. Was he had a very important meeting where he was going to break off relationship with his record label and his group. They all knew that. This was the breakup meeting that was going to be happening at the Mustang offices. The guys all turned up. The record company president was there. The rest of the band was there. Bobby wasn't there. Where was he? Excuse me. That's when everything started to fall into place with the location of his body and so on. At first, they were all very angry and thought that he was just pulling some kind of a prank or just trying to indicate how important he was and how they didn't count. They were angry when he didn't turn up at the meeting. Little did they know that he was dead.
We're visiting with Miriam Lena. Miriam is the author of the book, I Fought the Law, The Life and Strange Death of Bobby Fuller. Miriam, people who are listening might wonder, okay, Miriam, so tell me, you've told me pretty much a lot of the stuff I've read or heard about. What makes your book different from some of the other books?
Well, there haven't been any real books that have been out about his career. There have been chapters and there have been mentions. They all seem to proliferate. One particular story involving a career club owner in Los Angeles who was actually not even involved with the nightclub that Bobby was involved in. PJ's, just to go back in the history a little bit about PJ's, PJ's was started in Los Angeles out of a club that was called the Black Orchid, which musicologists and jazz fiends and even crime people will be able to associate with. The Black Orchid was a Chicago club famous for starting the careers of people like Johnny Mathis, Sam Cooke, many other artists, comedians, showbiz people, singers, piano players, what have you. It was also the club that Hugh Hefner used to frequent when he was looking at possibly opening a club of his own. His Playboy clubs came to be based on the Black Orchid, the way that the Black Orchid was run. It's a supper club with pretty girls serving the drinks and with great top entertainment and a really great atmosphere. He based his Playboy clubs on it. So the Black Orchid had a bit of a major history. Another part of the history is that Jack Ruby, strangely enough, the killer of Lee Harvey Oswald, also had connections there when he was trying to promote a young tap dancer who he was promoting. That's a long story, but Jack Ruby had musical ties in with Chicago as much as he did in Texas. At any rate, the owner of the Black Orchid, Paul Raffles, went and started left Chicago when he married a young lady from Chicago and left for California. Her father was a multimillionaire who, you know, it's safe to say, had major ties with people who were involved with the Chicago mob, with Yeltsin. He was actually conveniently married to someone who was involved with the outfit. Those people actually had huge ties in with California music. I don't think this is news to anybody. We all know that. The possibility and the probability of Paul Raffles being involved with those same Chicago people when he was back out there in California with the PJ's Club are pretty obvious. Just the fact that the money was coming in from a millionaire source in order to have the club operate was something. The club, interestingly enough, also with PJ's, which is famous for live recorded albums for many, many artists who have live albums that were recorded at PJ's. One of the people that I should mention, I don't know if this is of interest to you, is Trini Lopez.
Yes.
So at any rate, so with PJ's being operating as a kind of a swanky kind of a nightclub and to an older, more sophisticated showbiz clientele, this is the milieu that Bobby ended up catering to with the rock and roll. They had a rock and roll room in the back of the club. They had a jazz club out front that Frank Sinatra frequented at regularly in California, and other top stars were there. So that club was in the front. In the back was this rock and roll club, and they started to mingle. These different groups started to mingle. You'll see photographs of the Bobby Fuller Four with Mia Farrow, you know, posing at PJ's with the band. She was a fan. Other adult people would go back there, people who were involved in show business, the movies, the recording, would go back there and dance and befriend them. So it was an odd mix of people. Strangely enough, Sam Cooke, again, who had the tie-in at
the Black Orchid.
At the Black Orchid, because, you know, Bob Keane knew of him from the Black Orchid. He knew Paul Raffles from the Black Orchid. Sam Cooke also, I don't think this has been really written about. People know that Bob Keane was the first one to really issue any music of Sam Cooke's that really hit the public ears and eyes. But Sam Cooke, before he was murdered at the Hacienda Motel, he came from PJ's. He had stopped into PJ's. He left PJ's. Within a couple of hours, he was murdered. at the Hacienda Motel.
Miriam,
it's a strange connection. Sam would go to PJ's. I'm not, you know, does this have anything to do with the price of bread today? I don't think so. But it's a very odd connection that here's Sam Cooke. He's got a connection. Black Orchid, PJ's, Bob Keane, stops into PJ's that night. Oddly enough, he's murdered hours later. This is the kind of mix of and mayhem that was going on in Hollywood at the time. People who were coming, they're not Hollywood born. Nobody was Hollywood born. Very few people were. It's kind of like New York City. Everybody's from someplace else. They come here because the towns that they're in, perhaps that they've outgrown them. They don't have like-minded people who they want to associate with. They come to Los Angeles. They come to New York. They come from various parts, and they mix, and they don't really know what they're after, but they know what they want to, that they know the people that they want to meet up with. They want to meet like-minded people. That's what the scene was like at PJ's. Bobby was able to make great connections through there. The label was able to make great connections through there, but I don't believe that Bobby knew. Randy definitely did not know that there was any deeper connection between Bob Keane at PJ's and Larry Nunes, who was the chief financial operator for Stereophy, of which Mustang and Delphi became a branch.
Miriam,
so Delphi was a founded label, but it went under the umbrella of Stereophy. Mustang was a new label that became part of it as well.
Miriam, we want to thank you very much for being with us here today. We've been visiting with Miriam Lena. She is the author of the book, I Fought the Law, The Life and Strange Death of Bobby Fuller. Now, as Miriam mentioned, this is a book that looks inside the career of Bobby Fuller and the beginnings and what it was like to be Bobby Fuller, the musician. Thank you, Miriam.
Thank you so much, Louie.
This is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Belinda Fernandez. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.